Welcome back to New Books in Religion. Thanks again for joining us. I'm your host, Christian Peterson. The worlds of cinema and illustrated fiction are replete with exciting data for the historian of religion. Drawing on Tradition, Manga, Anime, and Religion in Contemporary Japan by Julian Thomas sets up a robust theoretical model for examining how the concept of religion is deployed in these mediums. Thomas outlines how the category of religion can be understood within the Japanese context and various reasons why religious markers and themes are reproduced in manga and anime culture. His detailed illustration of the typologies of the manga-anime-religion nexus is achieved through both narrative analysis of illustrated fiction and film, as well as ethnographies of digital and material environments. In our conversation, we discuss the production and marketing elements of manga, its uses for proselytization, some ritualized responses of audiences, famous authors and their works such as Tezuka Osamu's Buddha, religious movements derived from manga and anime culture, the religiously nationalistic elements of Kobayashi Yoshinori's On Yasukuni and On the Emperor, the filmic career of Miyazaki Hayao, and the role of manga in Om Shinrikyo's rise and fall, among many, many other things. Without any further delay, here's our conversation. Thanks again for listening to New Books in Religion. Today I have the pleasure of speaking with Julian Thomas about his great new book, Drawing on Tradition, Manga, Anime, and Religion in Contemporary Japan. Morning, Julian. How are you doing?
Hi, how's it going? I'm doing very well, thanks.
Yeah, thanks for making some time to talk to me. This is a really wonderful book, both really interesting topic. I think not many people are working on this kind of stuff in the study of religion, so I really appreciate that. But I also really appreciate your clarity and your methodology and kind of the purpose of the book, and I think it's a overall very, very good book. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much for saying so.
Before we get into kind of what this book is all about, I was hoping you could talk a little bit about how you got interested in the study of religion, how you got interested in the study of Japanese religions, kind of what brought you to the field, people that might have been influential in your approach or in the topics you study.
Sure. Whenever people ask me this question, I always hesitate for a moment because I'm not sure how far back to go. So, I think I could start by saying, I took classes when I was an undergrad at Grinnell College, but I think that the whole thing that brought me to religious studies classes in the first place was that, I grew up going to a congregational church, pretty liberal congregation in Des Moines, Iowa, and I found myself to be really disenchanted over the course of time with the church itself. There's this whole interaction that involved my confirmation experience where I didn't want to become a member of the church and my parents and grandparents really did. And I found myself being really disillusioned. And that was the beginning of this sort of angry teenage phase where I was like, down with religion, whatever. but I realized over the course of time that I actually found religion in the broadest sense to be really fascinating. And so I was kind of, I think in my later teenage years, I was really trying to figure out what it is that people think that they're doing when they say they're being religious, or why and as I became able to be more reflective, I was wondering, why was it that I felt like I didn't really want to become a member of my parents' church? What didn't feel right about that to me? So when I was taking classes at Grinnell, some of the first courses that I took that really got me going were really sparked my intellectual interest happened to be religious studies courses. I think the first one I took was a course in major Asian religions taught by Ed Gilday, who's just I think retired at Grinnell. And then I took courses with Henry Reitz on the Bible. Somewhere along the way, things just really sparked, and I felt like I finally had this opportunity to engage those questions that had sort of been in the back of my mind when I was younger. Yeah, another thing I noticed was just that in these religious studies courses I was taking, there are a number of people who are just, a year or two ahead of me, who seemed to be the most articulate, brilliant people I'd ever met in my life. They were just, out of this world smart. And I thought to myself that I wanted, you know, to be like them. And so, you know, I declared a religious studies major. And I should say that was right around the time where I was undergoing a different sort of non-religious conversion experience, where I'd been a very apathetic student, nearly got kicked out of school, actually. And it was kind of thanks to the religious studies courses that I discovered that I actually really liked being a college student. And so, you know, a number of the professors in the department really worked with me on how to craft an argument, how to write a longer research paper. And soon I found myself being deeply engaged with the material in every class. And by the time I graduated, I was, you know, I was already sort of thinking about going to grad school in religious studies. But I wound up taking a detour in that right as I finished college and I did an additional semester of student teaching, I happened to be, you know, dating somebody at the time who was making a move to Japan, and I was thinking that I really wanted to leave the country as well. So I just kind of dove right in and took a job in Japan. And so my next academic task, if that's the right word, became learning this new language. And so, you know, I spent a couple of years in Tokyo, teaching and, just trying to learn as much Japanese as I could. And, in the course of that, then I kind of inevitably wound up combining my intellectual interests in, my pre-existing intellectual interest in religion with, my growing interest in Japanese language and culture. And so that's sort of the germ of this book, came from that early experience.
Yeah. And in the book, you're somewhat explicit about your experience there and how trying to learn a language, kind of collided with this, body of, literature, right? So could you talk about how, how this, when did you decide that this is something I should write as a book? How did that idea emerge?
Right. It's really tough to go back and retrace this because, you know, we're talking about a decade or more now since this happened. But let's see. So first thing, just to speak briefly about learning Japanese, I had not taken any Japanese before I moved to Japan. So I moved there cold, and I wasn't taking lessons while I was there either. I was just kind of teaching myself. So I had to figure out really efficient ways to pick up the language quickly. And the urgency came from the fact that I never felt illiterate before. I didn't remember the feeling of being illiterate. And it really drove me crazy. So I felt like I needed to learn how to read the language around me as quickly as possible. And what I started doing was, you know, comparing romanized spellings with the kanji, which is the ideographic vocabulary that's used in China, and then the native syllabaries, which are called hiragana and katakana. And so I was gradually learning how to use these things, but to see them in their native context, I needed some way to have kind of a guide through them. And so I ended up picking up manga that are you know, pretty popular series that are aimed at children. And as I started reading those things, my vocabulary expanded, very rapidly. And you know, I didn't understand everything at first, but, after about a year of reading manga, I was able to have a conversation, pretty well and so on. But at the same time, I couldn't quite let go of this interest in religion, particularly because the Japanese approach to what we call religion, and I guess I should clarify that every time I'm using the word, you can imagine the scare quotes around it or whatever. There's a big deal in the field about like how we define religion and so on. And I, you know, in a minute, I'd like to sort of talk about my approach. But just in terms of what brought me to the book, I was seeing that you know, what I thought of as being religion, a lot of my Japanese interlocutors didn't think of as religion. So in the neighborhoods where I was living, there were temples and Buddhist statues and Shinto shrines everywhere. You know, I couldn't walk around a corner, it seemed, without running into some religious edifice. And I would see people, you know, making offerings to these statues that were on the roadside, or I would see people hiring a Shinto priest to do a groundbreaking ceremony when they were building the house right next door to on the empty lot next door to my apartment. And so it seemed to me that there was religion everywhere. But when I talked with people, most of the time they said that they didn't think of those activities as being particularly religious. And so that was really the kind of question that was driving my my research, which is basically, you know, if we are going to say that there is religion in Japan or there's something that we call Japanese religion, then where is it? Like, what is it that people are doing that we, as scholars of religion, could describe as being religious? And so that was kind of what I was trying to get at. And I, as I was reading more manga or watching more anime, I was finding all of these things that seemed to me to be places where people were regularly engaging in religious narrative, sometimes ritually engaging with content. And so that was kind of the thing that was really the motivator for the research project.
Great.
Yeah.
So could you talk a little bit about where this category of religion kind of fits in Japan? Because I think for many listeners who don't are not familiar with the Japanese context, I think this idea of what is religion in Japan has a certain history, right?
Where, yeah.
Like you say, most people say they're not religious. When you're talking to people about the things that you see religious, they're saying they're not. So how can we think about religion in Japan? What exactly are you talking about?
Yeah, thanks for asking that question. So as in many places in the world, I think that it is fair to say that there had always been a certain way of dividing the social life in Japan. If we go back to the early historical sources, we can see that special consideration is given to people who engage in certain types of ritual activity. A lot of times that's associated with politics or with governance. But we do see like sort of special treatment granted to Buddhist priests, for example. If you want to say that like having this special class of person who engages in a certain type of ritual activity or ritual service is religion, then I think we could go back and say, yeah, religion, like Japanese people have had a concept of religion or of a certain special path for quite some time. But is that equivalent with the modern concept of religion? I think many of my colleagues in Japanese studies would say, no, it's not. I think there's a difference of opinion in the field about whether it's better to just abandon the term entirely or only use it for the modern period or whatever. I tend to think that religion happens to be one of the best terms we have at our disposal to describe this stuff. And so I don't particularly have a problem using the term religion as long as we're careful to define how we mean by it. Since I'm a modernist, it's particularly easy for me because I tend to talk and write about Japan after in the 19th century and later. And at that point, Japanese people are interacting with Europeans who have introduced the category of religion in its modern sense. And Japanese people are actually contributing to the creation of that category, expanding its usage for Europeans. So without getting into too much detail, I think that we can say that from, say, the mid-19th century, there is this sense that religion is a distinct or discrete aspect of social life. And the meaning that it has in Japanese, the word shūkyō that it has, it sort of changes over the decades. But from the mid to especially late 19th century, you have this idea that there's this discrete thing that exists. The problem that arises is that very few people think of what they do as being religious. So if you today were to ask 10 people on the street in Japan, are you religious or do you engage in religious activity? 9 of the 10 almost certainly would say, no, I don't. I'm not religious. I don't do that thing. But if you were to ask them about a specific activity, like, did you go to clean your ancestors' graves during the equinox week or during Obon? It actually happens to be Obon season right now. It's kind of a time when people tend to venerate their ancestors. Then a lot of people would answer yes to that. So people are engaging in ritual activity that's based on this sort of presupposition that the ancestors exist and need to be taken care of, which to me sounds like religion, but to, you know, native informants, they don't categorize it that way. So then the dilemma that remains is, as a scholar of religion, what do you do with that information? Do you use the term religion to describe it, or do you try and use some sort of native way of describing it? Native sounds weird, but a local way of describing that. I can't say that I have settled on my final approach to this, but in the book, I was trying to say, okay, let's be honest about this. I'm a scholar of religion who's predisposed by his training to see religion in aspects of social life. So let me just assume that, and let me be explicit about that and say, I'm going to call these things religious, even though I'm acknowledging that some of my informants aren't going to be choosing to describe it that way. And, you know, I think some people would take issue with that, but at the time it seemed to me to be a reasonable approach to the dilemma about whether religion exists or doesn't exist in Japan.
Sure. I think you're successful in the book too, in talking about ways of thinking about religious narratives, social rights, these kind of things. And I think it makes sense in the context that you're working with. Now, that content, many people also might not be familiar with. So can you
sure.
give us a little bit of idea of what is manga, what is anime, what distinguishes these from other illustrated fiction that people might be familiar with?
Right. So simplest version would be that manga are like comics and anime are cartoons. It gets a little more complicated because I think when people hear the word comics, they might be thinking of like a comic strip that they see in a newspaper here in the United States, where, you know, you have three or four panels, or maybe one panel in the case of the Family Circus. But, you know, the manga can exist in that sort of form, but usually when people use the term manga now in the 21st century, they're referring to what I tend to describe as illustrated serial novels. In other words, they're these long, usually pretty long stories that would be initially published in weekly or monthly magazines in installments of about 15 or 20 pages, maybe a little bit longer. And then eventually those stories are collected into volumes of about 200 pages a piece. And those volumes, a set of those volumes can run into the hundreds. There are some very famous manga series and very popular manga series that would have just had ongoing serializations. I think it's a lot more common to have a manga story run somewhere between, say, 5 and 20 volumes. So, you know, roughly 1,000 pages, maybe several thousand pages for a story. And then in terms of the medium itself, every type of comics, if we use comics as the broad descriptor of storytelling, of sequential art, every type of comics will have some decision-making on the part of the author, illustrator, in terms of how to represent the passage of time, how to represent changes in scene from one place to the other. And manga tend to have a pretty broad range of how to represent that. And another way of thinking about that is, what happens in the space between each individual frame of the story. So manga artists might do a lot of close-up shots of various things that are happening at the same moment in time. Or they might show several things that are happening in different places simultaneously. And this is something that they actually, it seems likely that they borrowed from cinema and from the ability of a director to take a shot and juxtapose it immediately with another shot and create this sense of motion and or of two things happening simultaneously. So that's manga. I should say too that manga in Japan, they're read right to left. So books open the opposite way than they do here, and top to bottom. So you would be reading from the top right of a page, across that page, then down to the bottom right, across, and so on. Now, let's see. Anime are really just, they're cartoons, but they tend to have a stylistic difference from American cartoons in that a lot of times the camera will linger on a shot longer than is common in you know, Saturday morning cartoons. Or a camera might, or there might be very rapid cutting between from one scene to another to create, to exaggerate that sense of movement. But, you know, anime directors borrowed a lot of the apparatus and the sort of techniques for creating anime from studios like the Disney Studio and so on. But then they kind of added their own twist to it. And a lot of that had to do with sort of economic pressures on the industry and so on. And other people have written about this in much more detail than I have. I think a great book for anime is The Anime Machine by Thomas Lamar. I think it's University of Minnesota Press. He goes into great detail in the first 100 pages or so about the ways that filming anime creates this unique medium and so on. So there's good stuff out there for people who are interested in that. And a lot of it is cited in my book.
Sure. And who are the audiences for these? You in the book, you talk about the relationship between manga and anime. And you talk about the types of audiences. So
sure.
Who does this stuff? Because when I think in a, at least in America, when we think of comics, when we think of cartoons, we think of kids.
Right. Yeah. Kids certainly read manga and watch anime. But in Japan, and now increasingly outside of Japan, we see a much broader range. If you're on a Tokyo train, you could see a 60-year-old salaryman reading a manga. You could also see a grandmother or a, you know, 20-something so-called office lady reading a manga. The subject matter is just as varied as those demographics. So you'll have everything from science fiction and fantasy, which is a lot of what we see getting translated into the United, into English for audiences in the United States and elsewhere. But, you know, there are how-to manuals these sort of nonfiction introductions, like it's sort of similar to like the Idiot's Guide to whatever. You'll have those in manga form in Japan. You also have, I think for a while people tended to associate manga with eroticism because there is a certain corner of the market that is targeted to, helping people get their jollies, but that sort of thing that's does exist. It's a share of the market that I don't think we can ignore, but it is by no means the majority of the market. I think basically any topic that you can imagine being covered in a novel in English literature is definitely covered in manga. So you have your 50 Shades of Grey and you have your Hunger Games and you have everything else, including like the most profound pieces of literature and the most banal sort of jejun pieces of literature side by side when you're thinking about manga.
Now, you're very clear about kind of your methodology, how you think we should be approaching these types of materials. I wonder if you could just give us your thoughts a little bit about this idea of the medium. How can we approach sources where images or film or sound are so important to structuring the narrative of the text?
Right. Okay, so a big thing, and interestingly to me, this is true both of religious studies and of manga and anime studies, is that there's a tendency to overemphasize narrative and to downplay the other things that are contributing to the sort of synesthetic experience of whatever. You know, so when you see, and this, I don't want to make a blanket statement about people who are doing manga and anime studies or religious studies, but just that scholars are now aware of the fact that we used to just say, this is what the story says, without looking at how the story was being conveyed. And so in the case of manga and anime, that meant, well, you know, I've got this work by Tezuka Osamu. What's the story he tells, without looking at how he tells the story? In his case, like, he's got a famous biography of the Buddha that some people have been using in their classrooms and so on. And Tezuka is telling the story by modernizing it, making these asides that sort of bring, you know, 5th or 6th century BCE India / Nepal he sort of updates it for people who might be reading in Japan in the 1970s or 80s with little references and asides to contemporary culture. And also, importantly, and those are visual references, I should be clear, as well as verbal references. So there's that, but then there's also things I alluded to this a little bit before about just the pacing of the story and how the artist might move from one frame of a manga to the next. If the artist focuses a lot on different aspects of the same scene in individual panels that have, say, a picture of flowers or a picture of a person's fingers interlaced or whatever, is the author inviting the reader to take time, to take a moment to appreciate all of the different aspects of what's going on there? If the author chooses to just use image to portray a particularly profound moment, is that supposed to suggest that the content of that moment is ineffable? For example, I just referred to Tezuka's Buddha. So just to piggyback on that a little bit, when Tezuka is portraying the Buddha having his enlightenment experience, he does not offer an articulation that's verbal. You know, we tend to teach students about the Four Noble Truths and stuff like that. Rather, he just draws a picture of the Buddha seeing himself as interconnected with all these other dancing flowers and bears and you know, artichokes and octopi and stuff like that. So he's portraying this sense that everything is interconnected, which, you know, we could say is maybe part of the Buddha's enlightenment experience. But he's, in doing so, he's changing the very way that people might understand the content of that experience. And he's changing only in the sense that he is presenting it in a way that's different from the usual kind of verbal articulations that we would read in a textbook on Buddhism. Yeah, so paying attention to those visual cues and visual methods is really important. And I think that that's important particularly because, you know, in the field of religious studies, we're increasingly aware of the fact that religion is not just about assent to propositional statements of belief, nor is it about people just believing in a story, you know, the story of, you know, you know, a certain people being an elect people or of a certain person being a messiah. that it can be about all of these other things that have to do with, you know, the material body and so on. One person that's been doing interesting work on this recently is Brent Plate, somebody that I've been in dialogue with a lot about media and religion and so on, and kind of how there are all these ways that we engage with religious content that come through our various senses that don't have to do with just reading a story and following along. So I think that's what I was trying to get at in the book. Brent's done great work, both on the senses and on film and religion, that I highly recommend as well. But yeah.
Yeah. And we've talked to Brent here at New Books in Religion as well. So we are also a big fan of his work. Now, your narrative reading of these stories is great. But the other thing that's really interesting about your book is you pair this narrative approach with an ethnographic approach.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the type of ethnographic work you were doing. What kind of things were you thinking about around manga and anime, I guess?
Yeah. So I have to be, this is a tricky thing for me, because I think of the ethnography, the ethnographic aspect of this book as being its greatest strength and its greatest weakness. The way I had gotten midway through my research in Japan, and I realized that I had just been reading all these stories or watching all these films, but I wasn't feeling like I was getting closer to understanding what was truly religious about them. And I was sensing that I was just imposing my category of religion on these texts or these films. I hesitate to call them texts, but on these manga and anime. And basically what I was doing, if I was doing that, was just writing a book. It wasn't a book yet, but just writing a study about myself. And I wanted to rather be writing a study about, you know, people in contemporary Japan and how they were interacting with manga and anime, and what might be religious about that. So very late in the game, it occurred to me to start asking people. And I say very late in the game because, like I said, I'd gotten pretty far along, and I'd written some stuff. And then, you know, I started wanting to substantiate my claims. And my first way of doing that was to go to fan message boards dedicated to certain works. And I was just lurked on the boards and saw what people were posting and noticed that it was not uncommon that, you know, that I wasn't alone in seeing religion in some of these things, but also that it wasn't uncommon for people to describe in the relatively safe anonymous space of an online message board that, you know, they actually engaged in some sort of ritual behavior. What I saw as ritual behavior, I'm not sure if they always use that word, with the media in question. So then once I started seeing that with the online message boards, then I started, you know, I started following up when I would meet people, you know, a friend of a friend or something, and they asked me about my work. Then I would kind of say, oh, okay, well, would you be okay with me just asking you some questions? You know, so we'd meet at a cafe, I'd click on my tape recorder and we'd have a chat about, you know, what their experience was with manga and anime, what their thoughts were about religion, and if the two were connected at all. And, you know, I have to say, I called it a strength because I hadn't seen anybody really doing that sort of work before, but it was a weakness in that I came to it too late, and the interviews and the survey I did with some college students, it really was too little too late. And so one of the things that I did at the closing of the book was to say, you know, this is just a first attempt. I really hope that people will take this idea and move forward with it. We're already starting to see more books, being published on manga and anime that are, using ethnography to get at like what the industrial trends are and so on. But I would love to see, another book, a better book, come out that's, been done with, you know, detailed interviews with, both producers and consumers of manga and anime. I think it would be fantastic. So, if there are any, you know, grad students out there who are looking for a project to do, then, you know, it can be done much better than what I did in this particular book.
Well, we think you did great.
thanks.
Now, another thing to help us think about this idea of religion within the context of manga and anime is you outline certain typologies or categories of where religion fits in here. So can you tell us the ways in which manga is deployed in the ways in which religion is deployed in manga?
Yeah, actually, I don't think you misspoke there. Manga is deployed by religious groups to try and reach new audiences. I say new audiences because I think there's this sense, in the case of not all of them, but you know, there have been some manga that have been published by, say, you know, the Soto sect of which is a branch of the Zen tradition in Japan, and they'll have like the story of their founder Dogen, and it's, as you might expect, a sort of plodding biography of this sectarian founder. But then you see some other groups that are doing things where they're trying to tell an exciting adventure story and present the group's doctrine at the same time. One of the groups that's been doing that with a lot of verve, I'm not sure about the effectiveness of it, is a group that's called Kofuku no Kagaku in Japanese. They now go by the name Happy Science in English. They used to be called the Institute for Research in Human Happiness. But anyway, they have these marvelously produced anime and manga that they have been publishing for some time now that are, you know, designed to introduce people to sort of the cosmology and worldview of Happy Science and to get people interested. So that's one kind of thing. But then I think, like, if we were to think about this as a continuum or a range of types of expression with religion, then we have these things on one end of the continuum where a religious group is creating a manga or anime specifically to edify their current members or to capture new audiences. On the other end of the continuum would be, I think, the vast majority of stuff that we might call religious manga and anime, which is the kind of thing where an author or illustrator or director recognizes that religion is a particularly fecund source of all kinds of great stuff. It's the source of magic and miracles and so on, which means that religion is, you know, religious content is replete with convenient plot devices. So, you know, you have the girl who is whose family runs a Shinto shrine in Tokyo, and she falls down a well, and then she's transported to this magical world. Or you have the person who suddenly discovers that this Buddhist statue is walking and talking and offering to protect her from these bad guys. And so the religion that's involved is kind of aesthetic, you know, it's ornamental in a way in that it just moves the plot device along, but it incidentally exposes people to religious vocabulary, imagery, and ideas. And there's some stuff in the middle where people are, you know, kind of trying to get audiences to maybe pay a little bit more attention to religion or to lead a more examined life without necessarily saying you must convert to this particular religion. One person who's fairly famous who I think has been doing that is a fairly right-wing guy named Kobayashi Yoshinori. Several of his books have sort of taken on this hortatory mode where they're encouraging people to visit the controversial Yasukuni Shrine in central Tokyo, or to think of the emperor as a ritual specialist rather than just as a sort of political or symbolic figurehead. So, you know, there's a pretty broad range in terms of the religion in and of manga and anime. But one crucial thing is that I think to date, you know, when I was working on this book, I felt like most of the stuff, there wasn't a lot on religion and manga and anime, but what was out there tended to use the preposition in. Like, let's look at this manga and find the religion in it. And what I was trying to do was to sort of flip that around and to say, okay, we have, let's assume that there's religion here, but let's not assume that the religion is being transmitted through the medium. Let's rather think about the fact that the medium might be the site for the performance of religious activity. And again, this is where ethnography came in, and that's where I was starting to find people, you know, reading a manga and incorporating that into their religious worldviews or engaging in ritual behavior that was based on what they had seen in an anime and stuff like that. So
great. And speaking of kind of audience reactions and, you know, this as a site of where religion might be performed, there's one figure, Kuroda Minoru.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about who this figure is and what's going on around him?
Yeah. Kuroda is a really fascinating individual, and he was very generous with his time. He met with me a few times and we talked about his sort of life and work, and I guess what he would call his life's work, which is that he, let's see, he sort of fell into this career as a manga artist and was basically just one of those people kind of in the middle of this vast manga industry in the late 60s and 70s, where he was kind of drawing manga targeted to girls as a way, as he describes it, of just having a way to eat, right? But along the way, he became a member of a religious group called Mahikari, which means true light. It's a fairly large religious organization in Japan. And that really began to influence the material that he was incorporating into his manga. Now, he says that he was already drawing manga that caused some religious groups to contact him and to say, hey, you should come check out our teachings because they align with yours or whatever. For whatever reason, Mahikari, he clicked with Mahikari. And then there's sort of this schism in the late 70s, and he was kind of at a loss and had a moment of inspiration when he realized that it would be important for him to start his own group. It's a small group. It's kind of based on, the group was formally established in the early 80s, I think 1984 technically, but perhaps a couple of years before that. Anyway, so he establishes this religious group that's largely based on his, you know, his readership, and his manga are, how do I describe this? They tend to present protagonists as, you know, a protagonist will discover that she's died or that she's traveling through the world of the dead, and then some figure will appear to guide her along. And so that figure is really kind of the stand-in for Kuroda himself. And he's allowed, and it gives him the opportunity to sort of expound on his views about the spirit world and so on. And so he's published quite a few manga that way. And then he started publishing ordinary nonfiction where he would present this, his increasingly complex worldview, which is largely derived from Mahikari cosmology, to this audience of interested readers. He's got a website that sells various things, and then his group will have various sort of spiritual goods, they're called. And then his group will have these periodic meetings where they engage in this practice of transmitting sort of invisible flame from their hands, which has therapeutic effects and so on. Kuroda was, I have to admit, a bit evasive about the connection between what he does and religion. Although his group is officially registered as a religion with the Japanese government, he really doesn't like that term. He thinks that religion is outdated, and he prefers to think about the near future where the term religion won't even be necessary because it's an artificial distinction that people make. So I think it's important to recognize that he rejects the term religion, except when he's, you know, registering his group with the government. And then he says that that's the best thing. That's sort of the best description in that sense. But, so he's a really fascinating figure, and I think rare. I don't want to give the impression, and my intention in the book was not to give the impression that there are lots of manga artists out there who are founding their own religions. But it's not uncommon, I think, for people who already have a following to see the nature of that following change, or to adopt the stance of a teacher. And Kuroda has definitely done that.
Now, another chapter, you focus on film, and you specifically focus on Miyazaki Hayao, who lots of people might know of. He's very famous. Can you tell us a little bit about who this figure is, some of his more well-known films? And part of what I think you're doing in this chapter is critiquing how he's been approached and kind of assessed. So maybe before you kind of give us your perspective, you could tell us how would most people think of him?
Right. Okay. So Miyazaki is famous outside of Japan for films like Princess Mononoke and Spirited Away. And I think Spirited Away won an Academy Award in 2004. So this is a really well-known film. His films often feature young female protagonists who have some sort of coming-of-age experience. I guess in Princess Mononoke, you could say it's both a male and female, and maybe the story is more of the male protagonist. But at any rate, his protagonists are almost always young. They're almost always transported either magically or mechanically to another world, or to a or outside of their home. And then they come to have this new sort of appreciation for what the world is like, or something like that. I'm speaking very broadly about his work here. Obviously, there are variations in his stories. The reception of Miyazaki's work when it comes to religion has been, I think, a problematic sort of tendency to see that he is deploying certain types of figures and to assume that he has a religious message to transmit, or to assume that he unconsciously is transmitting a religious message. So you'll see these people who are saying, Miyazaki is preserving this ancient form of Shinto. That's triply problematic because he explicitly denies that that's what he's doing. Two, it's questionable whether we have a really good sense of what the ancient form of Shinto is, and it's especially questionable whether Miyazaki has any sense of what that is. And three, what's at stake for us when we're saying that he's transmitting this thing? And it's the third thing that really gets to me, because I feel like there's this sort of preservationist or conservationist impulse that a lot of scholars of religion have, or people who happen to be making reference to religion when they're writing about media or popular entertainment, where they see, they see this media form and they say, this media form is existing in a, to use another problematic word, secular environment, and maybe it is allowing religion to survive in an environment that's increasingly hostile to religion. And I completely understand where that comes from. I'm sympathetic to it, but I really don't think it's that helpful, because it seems to me more likely that the environment is not necessarily hostile to religion. The environment is changing, and the forms that religion is changing, or the forms that religion is taking, is changing as well, and are changing as well. So, to say that Miyazaki is preserving something, one, attributes to Miyazaki an attitude that he explicitly denies having, and two, kind of focuses our attention on the position of religion in society in a way that I think is ultimately unhelpful. I do share with these, with the authors who have written about Miyazaki in this way, a sense that there is something in his works that we can identify as being religious. But I think that we shouldn't assume that he is doing anything to necessarily preserve awareness of deities or anything like that. In fact, the deities who appear in Miyazaki's films seem to be ones that he is sort of made up or taking great liberties with. And they're the ones who are active, but almost always his representations of institutional religion are pessimistic. In Princess Mononoke, there's a venal monk who is certainly not a figure to be admired. In My Neighbor Totoro, there's no priest figure who appears, but there are statues that appear, and they tend to be inert, whereas you have this fuzzy tree spirit that the two young girls who are the protagonists of the film interact with. And so, you know, I think that to say that Miyazaki is doing religion kind of takes us away, without defining carefully what we mean by that, kind of takes us away from an understanding of what his work might actually be doing, especially if he says explicitly time and again, you know, I'm not into organized religion or institutional religion. So that's kind of what I was trying to do in that chapter. And I should say too that the book kind of, that's the core of the book, and that is the thing that I wrote first. And so the rest of the book kind of built out around that. So some of the stuff that's in the introduction where I'm laying out my methodology is really based on my reactions to Miyazaki's films and to the reception of Miyazaki's films.
Now, the final chapter revolves around this group, Om Shinrikyo, which a lot of people probably don't know about, I would assume. Mm-hmm. But if you know, people that work on new religious movements, things like that, might be more familiar with this.
Yes.
But you talk about how manga is employed to formulate a kind of identity and ideology for the group, but also how it's used to proselytize, and then ultimately how it's used to critique this group and some of its activities. So really interesting. I really like this as a case study. So could you tell us what this group is, and then where does manga fit into this group's kind of activities?
Right. Okay. So, first of all, Om Shinrikyo was the group that was responsible for a string of violent acts in the mid-90s. Most famously, members of the group spread sarin gas, which is a neurotoxin that's deadly, on several trains that were converging on Kasumigaseki Station in central Tokyo in March 1995. This horrific incident really shocked Japan, which is still to this day one of the safest places I've ever been. It's shockingly safe. So you can imagine in a place that is so safe, having this atrocious act committed was really a wake-up call to people. One of the quick reactions that appeared in the media right after Om's sort of nefarious activities came to light was to attribute the violence to the influence of manga and anime. And there was some fodder for this idea in that the leader and founder of Om Shinrikyo, Asahara Shoko, was known to have given sermons that were drawing on manga and anime. Like one that immediately comes to mind is this anime from the mid to late 70s called Space Battleship Yamato. So Asahara is kind of using that as a way of providing his own teachings, which are sort of this amalgamation of esoteric Buddhism and yoga. And he started incorporating kind of this idea about the end times in a biblical sense, and so on. So he's got this pastiche of religious ideas that he's building, that he had built by the mid-90s, that happened to draw upon the source material of some popular culture. So then journalists and some scholars of religion picked up on that, and they attributed the violence to, you know, Asahara as the evil mastermind, but then also to him taking advantage of the his followers' commitment to these fictional worlds. And I think that that's, there's some truth in that, but I think that that sort of oversimplifies what was going on, which is a very complicated religious worldview. And when we see these cases of religious groups engaging in violent behavior, I think it's really important to not engage in reductive analyses that say that it only comes from this particular doctrine or it only comes from that particular influence. Anyway, so the relationship between Om and manga continued in that Om, like several other religious groups of the time, was also producing manga and anime as a way of attracting new followers. And they, in the early 90s, late 80s, early 90s, they were, you know, on college campuses, they were trying to get new people to join the group. And they sort of hit a niche market in that they were very ascetic. And so people who really wanted to engage in ascetic behavior, I think were attracted to the group. But anyway, what I wanted to do in this last chapter, and then in a follow-up article, that came out the same year as the book, is to kind of engage with manga artists' reactions to Om and to see how they were using the manga medium to kind of put Om back in its place, or to renegotiate the relationship between religion and violence, or to renegotiate the relationship between religion and you know, ordinary society. And so I tried to find a few different examples of manga artists doing that in different ways, you know, like the evil cult leader mastermind, again, cult in scare quotes, but, you know, this evil leader who is, you know, raping people and killing people and stuff like that is one model that comes up in the chapter. But then there are other models that, in Urasawa Naoki's 20th Century Boys, where it's much more ambiguous about who's at fault for the behavior. You know, whereas on the one hand, you might have the authors of this manga Charisma that are saying it's the evil mastermind. In the case of Urasawa's story, over the course of the story, it becomes increasingly unclear who is responsible for the terrible things that have happened. And, you know, in many cases, Urasawa's finger seems to change. You know, is he pointing to the evil mastermind? Is he pointing to himself as the author, to the main protagonist, to the reader? And I think that he's being intentionally ambiguous and a bit provocative in terms of trying to highlight the fact that groups like Om don't just come out of nowhere. They're fostered by the society around them. So that's kind of what I was up to in that particular chapter.
Great. Is there anything else about the book that you want to talk about that we didn't get to address?
Well, you know, I guess the only thing that I want to reiterate is that this is, in my mind, very much a first attempt. It's a book that is immature, decidedly. It was based on a master's thesis rather than a doctoral dissertation. So it's got a there's a lot more that could be done with a more sophisticated kind of methodological approach that is more consistently engaged throughout the book. And I think that the program that I lay out in the introduction is one that I'm more or less happy with, but I'm not sure that I followed through as much as I would like to, would have liked to in the later chapters. So I guess what I would add is just that there is so much more work to be done on this topic. My current research is taking me in a completely different direction. So I really hope that other people pick up on it and do stuff with manga and anime. And the other thing I mentioned very briefly in the conclusion is video games. I think there's a lot to be done on religion and video games. Some people have been doing things with that in the American context, but you know, there's a whole different way of interacting with a story when you can control it to a certain degree. So that's the kind of research I'd love to see other people do in the future.
Yeah, well, I think you set out a very good model for how to approach materials like this throughout the book. So I think it's a great success.
Oh, thank you for saying so.
Yeah. Now, what kind of things are you working on now? Where has your research gone?
Yeah, so as I was indicating earlier, this sort of driving question behind the manga book, behind Drawing on Tradition, is this question about how we can responsibly define the category of religion in the context of contemporary Japan. And I would say that my abiding sort of research question continues to be about that sort of thing. You know, how can we responsibly define religion? But I've moved from kind of doing this contemporary study that's drawing on a lot of, you know, contemporary sociology and so on, to a much more historical focus. So my current project is looking at the politics of religious freedom, mostly in 20th century Japan. And the project is sort of divided into two parts. Part one looks at the politics of religious freedom during the time that Japan's first modern constitution was in effect, from 1890 to 1947. And whereas we've often been told that Japan had religious freedom on the books, but that in actuality, the government denied religious freedom to Japanese citizens, I'm showing that the situation is much more complicated, in that you have all these competing interest groups that are defining religion in different ways. They're defining freedom, liberty, and rights in different ways. And that affects how they are sort of advocating for or asking for greater religious freedom, or interpreting the Constitution, or engaging in legislation that expands or contracts religion's rights. So that's kind of the first half of the project, which is crucial groundwork for the second half of the project, which looks at a much shorter time period, which is the Allied occupation of Japan at the end of the Second World War. And in that part of the project, I'm looking at how, you know, the American project of spreading freedom to other parts of the globe operates, and a sort of early instance of that. But I'm also looking at how religious freedom starts to be constructed as a universal human right in a real sense. So we have this idea of, excuse me, I think I've run to the end of my vocal cords. For a couple of centuries before 1945, we have this idea of religious freedom as a human right, but it exists in pretty rarefied contexts, and it's not clear what a human right is. In 1945 and in the course of World War II, and especially at the conclusion of the war, people are suddenly responsible for defining what is a human right. What do we mean when we say that? And it turns out that in Japan, there was a lot of pressure to do that very quickly because of all of these sort of policy decisions that had to be made about how to instantiate religious freedom, and why the Japanese version was bad and why the American version was good, and so on. So it is, to me, this fascinating case study about how the meaning of religious freedom changes, about how military intervention and military occupation lead to these points of contestation over definitions of religion and freedom. And yeah, I'm really excited about where the project's going to go. So I'm going to be working on that book this next couple of years.
Great. Well, good luck with that, and we appreciate you taking the time to talk to us about this great book that you've already written. So thanks
again. Thank you so much. Thank you. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Religion. That was my conversation with Julian Thomas about his great book, Drawing on Tradition, Manga, Anime, and Religion in Contemporary Japan, which was published with University of Hawaii Press in 2012.